Leadership and Personal Growth with Suzanne Bragman and me, Neda von Riemann. In today's episode, we talk with Michelle Nevares, CEO at the Goleman Institute, about emotional intelligence. Michelle tells us what emotional intelligence means and why it matters in a professional environment, especially in a high-growth performance context in which usually only numbers and facts are primary focus. Michelle further explores why emotional intelligence is essential for a thriving performance of each individual and each company and how it reflects to a successful leadership role. We wish you lots of fun tuning into our first English episode with Michelle Nevares.
Welcome and hello to Michelle Nevares. Michelle, it's an honor to have you here in our podcast.
Thank you for having me very much. Very enjoyable to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. Just to quickly introduce you to our listeners, you are the CEO of the Goleman Institute of Emotional Intelligence, and you've been there for 3 years now. And before that, you already were an HR executive and you already were a coach in the corporate world. So Michelle, I guess our first question would be, could you tell us about your journey to the Goleman Institute? What brought you there? And can you also describe for our listeners what you are doing at the Goleman Institute?
You bet, absolutely. So Goleman EI was founded in the October timeframe of 2019. And we were started as a company in the springtime and really got up and running about that time. But we'd already begun creating the suite of products that we offer to our clients now, both in the business-to-business space as well as to individuals. And so it was in around the 2015-16 timeframe that I came together with my business partner at that point, and Daniel Goleman, and the three of us had a vision to democratize emotional intelligence, and specifically to take emotional intelligence from the realm of theory and concept and academia into the realm of the practical and application. And how do we really apply the best of what we understand about how the brain works and how emotions work in our day-to-day lives? And so that's the work we do with our clients, both global multinational organizations of every kind, as well as individuals in terms of how they can develop their inner coach and then also work with, a coach if that's what they choose to do within that framework. So
that's really interesting. And could you also tell us, because I know you told us that story in our pre-interview, and we both really loved it, how you met Daniel Goleman and how your path crossed. So I really loved that story. So I would love to have it on the podcast as well, of course.
Absolutely. And I'll be very honest. You may hear different angles of the same story, but I'll tell it nonetheless. So initially, Hanuman Goleman and I met in our 20s when I lived in Nepal. And I was helping to start a university at that time called Rongjung Yeshe Institute, which is still up and running today, offering Amazing. Bachelor's and master's and PhD programs in Tibetan Buddhist studies and language. And so that's based in Kathmandu. And at the time, Hanuman was on a Buddhist studies program, the same program I had been on a few years prior, and was doing his field study in Nepal when we just met randomly. So, and we stayed connected over the years, not closely, because back then we didn't really have social media. And so we got reconnected through Facebook. I don't even remember what year exactly, but we started talking again in 2015 when I lived in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where I was the head of HR for the hospital there. And I was able to come into contact with Daniel Goleman again. I had known him in a variety of settings, mainly from a practice setting within Tibetan Buddhism, but we had invited him there as part of a speaking series of a larger community-wide program in the city in which we were introducing concepts of emotional intelligence and cultivating well-being based on Dr. Richard Davidson's work, who's a neuroscientist based at University of Wisconsin. So it was that confluence of events that brought us together and got us talking about the work that we really loved and were doing on our own independently, each in our own way at the time.
I really love how passionate you all are about that topic and how your path crossed in life several times.
Yeah, it's interesting how that happens sometimes. And the further connection that I didn't anticipate was that that Daniel Goleman and Dr. Richard Davidson went to school together and were quite good lifelong friends, and I had been doing work with Dr. Richard Davidson and his team and University of Wisconsin, specifically to take Dr. Richard Davidson's work on the emotional life of your brain and the research he's done over the past 30 years into the business space. And so it was kind of ironic that that's what brought me to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and that's what caused me to meet Daniel Goleman again after all of those years and realized we had a lot in common and a lot of common work we wanted to accomplish.
Amazing. Great.
Thank you so much. And Michelle, for our listeners, could you quickly describe what emotional intelligence is? And when you work with your clients, how would your work look like? I mean, how do you approach your clients? How are your clients approaching you? And how would you work with them to get to the goal of emotional intelligence, so to speak?
Wow, that's a big question. If you'd asked me the same question about even just 6 months ago, I might have answered it very differently. And I'll explain a little bit why. So the definition of emotional intelligence that is utilized within Daniel Goleman's model is basically an awareness of one's own emotions and their impact on you and on others, and then also having an awareness of other people's emotions and the impact that that has on the relationship. And so that's the kind of traditional definition of emotional intelligence. But if we look at, what is emotional intelligence from a scientific standpoint, which is not something that I think is discussed about as much. We have to look at, well, what is emotion? And where do emotions come from? And what is the best of our understanding in terms of how emotion works in the brain? And so there has emerged new research that is quite fascinating in this regard that distinguishes something we think about as and is called classical view of emotion and then the constructive view of emotion. And they're very different understandings of how emotions function and even what emotion is. And that's why I said I'd answer that question very differently 6 months ago before really understanding the most recent neuroscience. And so the way I define it now is, because there isn't this thing necessarily that is pinpointable that we could call emotional intelligence in the same way we could sort of pinpoint and measure IQ, for example, then if we think about what does it mean to be intelligent about emotions, then we need to understand how they operate in the brain. We need to understand how they operate in our bodies interoceptively, how to recognize our emotions, and how to work with them skillfully when they come up. And so that would be my quick answer.
It's totally interesting. I've recently read Shauna Shapiro's Good Morning, I Love You. And I've read something that I've never even thought about. She wrote that the emotional centers of your brain send messages and signals through your body. So your emotions essentially travel through your body before they even reach your cognitive part of your brain. And there's no direct connection or pathway between both centers, which for me was like mind blowing, because it essentially means that it defines mindfulness in a whole other way, because now it's not that you recognize emotions with your brain and interpret them, but you have to recognize the signs your body is giving you to Yeah, to understand your emotions better, I found that that's really interesting.
I learned that in an anatomy course that our fascia is connected with our brain and our emotions, and it fits totally to what Suzanne just said. So I learned it in a yogic context that when you do specific movements, your body recognizes them and sends specific hormones, which then create specific emotions like fear or anger. So your brain thinks there is some danger near you, and you have to be careful around you. So that's really fascinating how our emotions are connected to our body.
Yes, and I'm not familiar with the work of the person you mentioned, and so I apologize for not having, you know, familiarity with that to be able to speak to it directly. But I think what you're hitting upon touches on the two views of emotion, actually. And in the classical view of emotion, most of us, myself included, have been taught to think of emotions as kind of having a signature, each emotion being identifiable in, you know, our bodily signals or our expressions, and that would be universal across different cultures or languages. And that's very much the classical view of emotion, as well as this idea that emotions are triggered in us. There's kind of a stimulus response base model. However, with the work that has been done most recently by Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's a neuroscientist based in Massachusetts, who wrote a book that I'd really recommend really to both of you and any of your readers, called How Emotions Are Made. According to her research, what she has found is that emotions don't actually have a signature, and they don't have the kind of, you know, kind of fingerprint, as it were, where it would be the same across cultures and languages. And in fact, what she's found is that we have instances of emotion, and no two emotions are the same between two people or even within yourself. And so you can have moments of what we would describe, of course, we have to use words, right? But sadness or anger moments, but they're quite different from each other. And so she's also found in her research that it isn't a kind of stimulus response-based model as we think, that the brain actually simulates its own reality and makes its best guess or prediction about what's going to happen next. And in order to do that, it relies on our prior experiences, mm-hmm. as well as what I'll just sort of, this is my language, not hers, our social identity. And that is those things that have influenced how we've come to think about things, our mental models. And you know, and then in the process of the brain projecting what it thinks is going to have happen next, it then consults and does what we call sort of prediction error correction. And using the real-time sensory input of our five senses, as well as, you mentioned, what's happening internally on it, what we call an interoceptive level. And so we have our physical sensations, and some of which, many of which, are we're not really even in touch with, right? And so the brain has to make sense of those things, and it does so through something called affect, which we could think of as sort of the valence, as it were, of emotions. So whether something, you know, ranges from being positive or negative, and then what I like to say, salience or its strength, right? We have varying levels of strength of these instances of emotion. And so what you mentioned about our bodies and being able to, often our bodies give us the first signals about what's happening. And then cognitively speaking, the brain uses concepts to understand and make sense of and parse the meaning of those sensations that we're feeling. And so it's a very complex process that's even hard to explain. But that is the kind of gist of those two lines of thinking between classical and constructed.
Would you say, as every human being has emotions and sensations in in a specific way, that everybody has a degree of emotional intelligence, or would there be human beings for which this concept of emotional intelligence kind of just doesn't apply because they don't have it, or they just have a really low level of it?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. So the best of what I understand, again, not being a neuroscientist, but having this be the work that I do day in and day out, I'm speaking very much, I would say, from a practitioner's point of view, or someone who takes sort of those key insights from science and tries to make them accessible to people in an everyday fashion, in a practical way. But the best of my understanding, from reading Lisa Feldman Barrett's work on this question you ask, is that people have varying levels of what she terms emotional granularity. And so here's the general idea. There are certain concepts, even words, that exist in one language or one particular context that don't in another language or, you know, social context. And when we don't have the concept and the word to articulate what we're feeling, then the way we describe those sensations we're having are going to vary. And even the possibility of emotions that may exist because we have the habit of calling them by a particular word and associating them with a category of concept, then emotion can vary by culture mm-hmm. and by person. And so the general thought is that the greater emotional granularity we have, and that is the ability to identify more specifically based on our ability to tune into what's happening interoceptively and to give it words, to give it emotion concepts, then that would increase what we think of as our emotional vocabulary. And so people who don't necessarily have emotional granularity, it isn't that they don't experience emotions, but they may not articulate them with the same concepts or language. And so there are conventions, right, that we have to use when we describe what we're feeling and that other people can understand it, if that makes sense. But to answer your question about emotional intelligence per se, it all depends on how we define it. And so if either definition, even if we define it as familiarity with how one is feeling, one's own emotions and their impact, or whether we say it's the ability to tune into one's emotions, both are capabilities that every human being has the ability to do and has the ability to learn how to do.
That's relieving.
Right? Like, phew. So, however I was dropped in this world, I'm okay. I can start where I'm at.
Great.
It's good to know, especially in a business context. When it comes to good leadership, we are deep believers that emotional intelligence is the cornerstone, so to speak. But I think you, as an expert, you can describe to us and to our listeners why it is so important for a leader to be emotionally intelligent.
Yeah. So when we look at the various models of emotional intelligence, of which there are a few different models out there, I'm most familiar with Daniel Goleman's work, as well as a former professor of mine, Dr. Richard Boyatzis, with whom they formed that model. And I did my master's degree with Dr. Richard Boyatzis at Case Western. And so I'm very much going on what I've learned from that context. That model is considered what we call a behavioral competency model. And so that framework, the four domains of emotional intelligence, which would be our self-awareness, as well as our what's traditionally called self-management or self-regulation, would be the second domain. And then the other two domains have to do with how we interact with others, right? So basically our social awareness of other people and their emotions, and then what we think of as relationship management, how we interact with others. So those are the four domains of that model. And within those four domains, there are 12 competencies. And originally how this particular model was formed quite some time ago, well over 25 years ago or thereabouts, when Dan first wrote his first book, was derived or arrived at by studying global blue chip companies, I think around 188, if I'm not mistaken. And they looked at the competency models of those organizations and then synthesized their best understanding of what differentiates a top leader from a mediocre one, a truly excellent leader from someone who is maybe lagging where we would hope to see them leading. And that's, I think, the inspiration behind the current model, which has had some tweaks to it over the years, but very few. On the other hand, if we look at, okay, emotional intelligence outside of the context of business competency models, and that really is a reflection of what companies value, isn't it? It's they've elevated what they think is important, and so then it makes sense that that model would reflect those values. But a lot has happened in the last 25 years, and what we value today, sure, there may be some things that are similar, of course. But if we look at emotional intelligence more from a brain basis, then I would turn more to Dr. Richard Davidson's work, where he writes about in his book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain, which came out in 2013 and is a New York Times bestseller. I'd also recommend that to you and your readers. He identifies the brain basis of what he terms six emotional styles. And it turns out that those emotional styles are a perfect overlap with what we've come to in our programs term the foundational skills of emotional intelligence. And so these are things like self-awareness, focus, what I like to call emotional balance, which essentially conveys the idea of not just how quickly do you recover from a setback, but how quickly do you become reactionary, or how do you react? What's your baseline to react to a situation? And then how quickly do you recover? And then other skills or competencies like empathy or compassion, positive outlook, and finally adaptability. And so in Dr. Richie Davidson's work, while he uses slightly different terms, what he has identified is the brain basis of how we could get better at these things by virtue of specific practices that have been studied. And so to answer your question and come back to the source of your question of why it's important, well, self-awareness, or just you could say even awareness in general, since there are many kinds of ways of being aware, is critical for everything we do in life, not just business, but doing anything well, consciously or intentionally. And so I think from that basis alone, everything unfolds from that ability that we all have to be aware, to be conscious of what's happening in the moment.
You just mentioned the four main components of emotional intelligence, being self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, and let's call it social skills. So we would like to take a deep dive into those components to understand them a little better, because I think everybody has a sense of what is meant by those words. But how would you, for example, if we start with self-awareness, how would you understand that term in a context of emotional intelligence, or to develop more self-awareness with your own emotions and being more authentic with who you are?
Nice. So there are a lot of elements to think about, different levels when we talk about self-awareness. On the one hand, it is an awareness of one's emotions and what's happening, but it's also the ability to understand what's unfolding at any given time within your mind stream. And so at any given moment, we're not really generally, unless we're meditating, tuned in to what is happening. So the movement that's happening in our mind by way of thought, feelings, emotion, memories, ideas, any kind of mental movement whatsoever. And so that we could be self-aware would mean that we have an awareness of what's happening at that subtle level. And that takes practice, of course. And so that's one kind of self-awareness. But the other element of self-awareness is, and we spoke about it a little earlier or alluded to it, and that is on an interoceptive level. In other words, what's happening relative to one's bodily sensations or those sensations that are happening on a physical level, and how our emotion manifests on that level, and our ability to tune in and be aware of it. That is, I'd say, a different definition and then another nuance of what it means to be self-aware. And then finally, there's the aspect of introspection and the ability to reflect upon things that have either already happened or even to connect with one's intention for the future. And so our minds, our awareness have the capacity to do so many things. And self-awareness is just one type of being aware, but a very important type of being aware and a good starting place for sure.
I often think that self-awareness is really important to, in particular, remain emotionally stable towards your friends, towards your family, towards your employees and your colleagues. And I often had the impression in what we do, there are certain types of managers or leaders who sometimes act out or not emotionally stable. And I think it's a matter of fairness and also respect for the people surrounding you that you show them emotional stability, that you give them a safe place to communicate, to show your emotions, to discuss things. And I'm often afraid that people are lacking the skill, and I'm asking myself and I'm wondering, how can you train self-awareness for yourself, but maybe also for your employees or your colleagues? How would you train this with your clients?
That's a great question. So there are lots of different ways to train in self-awareness and awareness in general. And some of the key ways that we would look at are through what we would term training for the brain or contemplative practice. And so there are so many forms this can take, but some of the forms that you might be familiar with or some of your listeners would be what we would call attention training. And so it's training our ability to selectively direct our attention and where we focus. And isn't it true that we can focus on a single either object or thing, either that's, you know, our breath, for example, or an object outside of us? And the training is when you're mind or attention or awareness wanders and deviates from the thing you're focusing on, that you'd bring it back. It goes away and you bring it back. And like that, you build a habit of training one's attention. And so that's typically referred to either as attention training or meditation with focus. But we also have the capacity to selectively direct our awareness in a wide open or spacious kind of way, because the mind has that inherent quality to be spacious. And so we would call that open awareness practice. And instead of bringing our attention again and again to some point of focus, we actually allow our awareness to be expansive and vast and simply awake and present as it is, without a job to do, and to just be how it is naturally. And so that is a different kind of attention training, right? It's expansiveness, it's openness, spaciousness. And sometimes when we practice these kinds of contemplative trainings or training for the brain, then we get better in real life at being able to shift our perspective in a difficult moment, as you say. So when, as humans, whether we're at work or at home, and something becomes salient for us, and or we feel the valence of our emotion, and it completely captures our attention, then that's all we can see in that moment. It's, I like to use the analogy of a lake. And when that lake is very calm, that is our nature, very calm. The mind is very calm. But if you introduce waves, and in this case, you could say the waves would be emotion or something you're that's salient for you, then we become the wave. And so being emotionally intelligent is being able to take a perspective where you aren't so wrapped up in the wave being the wave, but you get to sort of take some distance and say, it's just, it's energy moving through me and it will pass and that wave will calm down, so that you don't damage things, in this case, relationships, in the process.
I like that. That also reminds me to what I learned when I was studying meditation, that you are not your thought, and to learn to differentiate your awareness and your being from your thought you're having. And you're not your thought. You don't have to identify yourself with what you're thinking. So having no judgment towards your distractions you're facing, and just bringing your mind and awareness back to, for example, the breath again. So I feel like self-awareness is really connected to meditation.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And this point you mentioned just now is a really, really important one. We aren't our thoughts, and we aren't even our emotions. And these are temporary movement of the mind and the body vis-a-vis sensations. And even just, you know, on the one hand, you mentioned thoughts, but if we look at emotion, often they manifest first as sensations in the body. And so just that act of noticing how it's manifesting in the body, and even putting some words to it or emotion concepts, helps sort of take the wind out of the proverbial sails of the strength of that particular instance of emotion. And so while I'm not quite sure why physiologically that's the case, my hypothesis is that, honestly speaking, whatever we focus on engulfs our attention, for better or for worse. And so if we, in a moment of having emotional turbulence, can focus on something different or even change our relationship to that experience, then that will create some shift to which we being our brains and bodies, have to react and give us an opportunity to do something a bit differently, maybe hopefully more skillfully.
How would you say is self-regulation connected to self-awareness? And how would you define self-regulation? Is it an ability to, instead of just reacting to your emotions, to taking a breath and stepping back and having that moment of stillness, and to lead yourself and your own emotions based on your own values before you react to whatever you are facing?
Nice. Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it, actually. At a brain level, and again, this is drawing from Dr. Richie Davidson's work on resilience, because what you're talking about really is resilience. It's being able to recover from a setback quickly and not being hijacked, as it were, by your own perception of what's happening. And so there's thought to be between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex, something called the uncinate vesiculus. We can just think of it as a highway between those two areas of the brain. And when that connection is stronger, and by the way, it can get stronger through training for the brain and specific contemplative practices, then our understanding is that the prefrontal cortex downregulates the amygdala when it's been jangled or upset. And that's the thinking anyway in that school of thought about emotion and self-regulation. But, you know, it's a tricky thing because the mind doesn't always behave. And in fact, it rarely does. And the moment we try to strong arm it or get tough with it, it's going to do just the opposite, probably. And so this is where having a working knowledge of how your thoughts work, how your emotions work, because you've noticed, you've turned the focus from, you know, watching the outside world to happening, what's unfolding in my mental stream or my mind stream. And you do that enough that you start to see some patterns and you start to know yourself better. And then you can understand what are the precursors that I'm going to feel, both on a physical level, but even what are some of the clues that that you give yourself. And so if you can key into what are those things for you and some strategies to employ reminders in the moment, these can be phrases, these can be visual cues, then it makes remembering, that capacity we have to recall or to remember, which by the way is the actual definition of mindfulness. If we go to the source of what mindfulness actually means, it means to be able to recall or to remember. And what is it that we're remembering or recalling? We're recalling what's important to us. We're recalling what is the rudder. It's like the inner rudder of your mind, and being able to be the one that's holding the reins, so to say, as opposed to the one who's being dragged around by your own emotions or your thoughts and feelings. So it's, you know, you can hear it's not a something we check off the box. It's an ongoing practice of familiarization. And so in fact, the word meditation in Tibetan means to become accustomed to one's own mind, to get used to. And so what are we doing? We're getting used to what's happening and noticing things differently than we normally do, paying attention.
That's so interesting, because when I think about self-regulation, I always think about being reactive versus being proactive. Mm. And then what comes in my mind is Stephen Covey's work, and we've talked about this in our first interview. And he says you need to build a mission statement and you have to identify your core values, which you are acting upon. And this will help you to never be reactive, but more proactive, because you're just acting on the basis of your core values and not just the environment that's surrounding you. And sometimes it strikes me that, especially in a high performance environment, people have like monodimensional values, like it's just about the career, it's just about the success. And I often think, is it really worth it? Does the success compensate for, don't know, your ruined relationships, your ruined health maybe, or even weak character or other things like that? And I'm just wondering, how can you approach those people? How are you working with your clients? Do you help them to define your core values, to find them? How are you helping them finding their way?
That's a great question. Wonderful question. So in the coaching model that we train as well as utilize with our clients, we utilize something called the 12 self-discoveries. And the 12 self-discoveries emerged really just from working with clients over the years and seeing the common areas they get stuck again and again. These habitual patterns of perception, sense making, how we interpret our perceptions, and then how we react to our perceptions. And there are some common themes. And so when we start working with a client, what we're ultimately trying to do is help ignite their inner coach. So that aspect within ourselves that we could be our own wise counsel, and igniting that inherent wisdom that we have and that can unfold from what? From our awareness, from the qualities of awareness. And the more accustomed we are to being aware, then good qualities unfold from that. And so in terms of, you know, how do we set sort of that measuring stick, to get back to your point, by which we want to live our lives and by which we will know at the end of the day whether it was a good day, a bad day, or somewhere in between, or what aspects were good, what aspects were less good. We each have a measuring stick that we either set intentionally or that gets set for us by default that we don't revisit. And so when we work with clients, we like to understand what is that measuring stick? What are those guiding principles and values? And work through a pretty extensive process of what I call the mind-body map, where we are identifying our social identity and the things that have given rise to our mental models and what we believe. So it's things like our upbringing, our education, our context, and we each have so many contexts, right? And then our self-identity. What is really, truly meaningful? What are my motivators? What are my drivers? Why do I get out of bed every day? And am I living the life I really want to live and that is fulfilling? And so we go through a process of self-discovery to find out what are those things. Because even if you know them in one moment, they change. They evolve over time, don't they?
It's a journey, right? It's a never-ending journey.
You know, it's fun to start to understand where you have influence over your own life and where you have influence most directly in your own mind, in the moment, based on your own awareness, which is the smallest common denominator of what you do have the capacity to connect with.
There's one very specific question or topic I would like to discuss in this regard, because it's so important, I think. As our listeners might already know, we are big fans of Bob Iger. And when it comes to self-regulation, I think one of the biggest and most important columns is integrity. Act with integrity towards yourself and towards others. And Bob Iger said that the quality of integrity in their people at Walt Disney is what is most important thing to him, and that he expects him and his employees to behave towards other people exemplary. And I think that's such an important point, and it really reminds me of another podcast I heard with Daniel Goleman. And he said, people are often asking me, how do I create a business ethos? And you're saying, like, there is no business ethos. There's an ethos. There's ethical behavior and integrity, but there's no business integrity or business ethics and no personal business ethics. You have it or you don't have it. And I would really like to discuss it, because I think that often falls through the cracks.
Yeah. That's an interesting perspective. And, having been in corporate for 25 years as an executive for a good portion of that time, what I found is the more senior level roles I would take on, of course, then just the nature of being in human resources meant that I got to see every manner of situation that humans involve themselves in, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And you know, many of those issues were ethical issues and issues of integrity. Mm. And I think if you don't know what comprises your ethics, and if you haven't done sort of meaningful work to really parse what that looks like in terms of how you treat others, how you treat yourself, how you show up on a day-to-day basis, then it's kind of like hoping to get somewhere without knowing where you're going. And so I think, and we all make mistakes for sure. None of us is perfect, but being able to keep your eye on the most important things and the degree to which you either are or aren't living in alignment with those things often is a measure overall of your sense of well-being and your sense of purpose. And so there's correlation between those things and being able to do them well.
Yeah. And for me, it also means to have, to be able to create a place where people trust you and know you treat them fairly, and you can have the same trust and fairness in regard to your own person, to allow to be vulnerable and to show that you're a human being and you have emotions and you do mistakes, as you just said. So we are no machines. So mistakes and failures can happen, but they are okay, because for me, it means they show that you grow and that you learn something new, because nobody of us is perfect. And we do sometimes have opinions that are not right. And the factual components do change, research changes. So it's okay. And it's a sign of intelligence as well to be open about your thought again, and you changed your mind and you had a misconception, but now you learned something and you grew. So absolutely. I think that is something that is often missing in a high performance environment, especially because people are afraid to show mistakes and failures because they think they will not get promoted or don't get the exciting new project because the boss thinks they can't handle it. But for me, that means showing vulnerability and showing that you're a human being and that you are able actually to serve better for your client, because you show when you went the wrong path that you can correct it.
Yes.
Instead of sticking to the wrong way just to keep your face.
Yeah, I think that's really wise what you just said. I completely agree with you.
And would you say empathy is connected to that? So you understand people and where they're coming from. So for one point, you keep talent near you. So it's good for your company to have talented people and to let them grow, but at the same time, connect with them and showing that they can be human and they can open up to you. So you have that kind of professional level with them. But also that human level with your mind and your heart as well.
Yeah, nicely put. Also, empathy and compassion are interesting topics. And, in Daniel Goleman's work, he talks about three levels of empathy. And on the other hand, we could talk about the concept of compassion. And the way I think about it is at least in a few different ways. Like anything, we can connect to something cognitively or intellectually, right? We can sort of with our brain rationalize or reason or connect cognitively to sort of say, oh, that situation's unfortunate. Or maybe you yourself have had a situation or could imagine it. And so that's a kind of cognitive or intellectual way of empathizing. But then there's sort of what you mentioned, of truly caring and connecting on a personal level, genuinely caring about someone's welfare and well-being. And those are two different things. They may be cousins of each other or in the same general family, but they feel differently. And if you know someone has your very best interests at heart and knows enough and cares enough to know something about you personally, then that empathy is going to feel more genuine and is going to be what we think of more as empathic concern, genuine care. Whereas compassion, I like to think about as we can't help but act. You know, we have no choice but to help another person who is struggling. And it's a different, I think each type of empathy or place we're operating from is slightly different than the other. And last point I would say is that when you have a connection with how you yourself feel, and you've had a chance to be reflective in your life, then you know that the moments of suffering and when we're really feeling like life is testing us and pushing us and pulling us even, then it's very in those moments where we can have compassion for ourselves, which is perhaps the hardest thing to do, then our hearts just open to other people and we literally feel with them. And so these are different nuances of this concept around empathy. And so there are different ways we can train ourselves and practice really being open and extending yourself beyond the confines of even those that you care about and are close to, but in fact, a perfect stranger. And so that takes some practice. But if you're connected with your own heart, then it's not actually that conceptual, these moments of compassion. They're more like sensations or feeling moments, I think, when they're genuine.
When it comes to to empathy and also emotional intelligence, and I know we've discussed this the last time, we often have the impression that in a high performance environment, people think they don't really see the substance behind it. And I would like to discuss this topic from a more economic angle. Mm-hmm. Because, I've read a couple of days ago that it's 10 times as tough to acquire a new client than to maintain one. And I think it might be similar with employees. So when it comes to the economic angle, what would you say? Why are your clients choose to work with you? What are you showing your clients when it comes to maybe even numbers? Is there any return on emotional intelligence or even empathy?
Yeah. It's a great question. So, and we may have touched on this in our pre-interview, but this is very nuanced because there's so many factors, first of all, to the current definition of emotional intelligence. It's comprised of so many skills and competencies. And so it's hard to measure. That said, I think it's not that hard to see. So while it may be hard to empirically measure it, although we do, there are studies, by the way, plenty of them that show that certainly companies can be more profitable and productive with emotional intelligence. For me, that's not, and again, this is just me, that doesn't get me that excited. What gets me more excited is when people can be kind and calm and clear mm-hmm. with each other and with mm-hmm. themselves. For me, that's the highest demonstration that something worked in the training. If you can be kinder in situations that doesn't matter what they are, if you can maintain your calm such that your decision-making capacity is not impaired or unduly biased by what you're feeling in the moment, whether you care to acknowledge how you're feeling or not, we all have emotions. Just because you don't express them or articulate them does not mean you don't have them. And so it's a skill to be able to maintain that calm and poise and balance, as it were. And finally, clarity of mind. You know, when we are driven or pulled around by our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings, we're not in charge, are we? And so in order to sort of take the reins back and maintain clarity of purpose and mind, which have to be good for business, I would think, then we need to train in that. And so for me, though, that's the evidence of emotional intelligence mm-hmm. are those three things.
I really love that you say that we need to be kinder and don't become too hard, but stay and remain soft, soft and kind. And I think people are often mistaking that with being weak, but I think the opposite's the case, right? Yeah.
Because it indicates your ability to be resilient, adaptable. If you look at what is actually needed in business, isn't it that? Circumstances are always changing. We have to switch gears. We can't get too rigid, stuck on things. And what allows us to do that is a flexibility of mind, of our own mind, and our own perception of what's happening in the moment. And we also know the kinds of places we like to work and that we can thrive in. And we all like to be treated kindly. We all like to, as we said earlier, have a certain level of security, knowing that in one moment we're going to be treated more or less the same as we are in the next, as opposed to sort of an emotional roller coaster where everybody's on pins and needles. Those are the kinds of teams that don't thrive, that aren't high-performing teams, where fear is high. Then how can you truly be at your best? So I think of it as creating the conditions, both internally and externally, to do your best work and to be at your best. And so it's a different way of thinking about things, I think, than certain historical models. But we all see how well those work, don't we? Not so well.
I personally, I'm convinced that friendliness is the key, not only in personal life, but also in a professional and even in a high performance background. And that only with friendliness, you attract people who have values and who have integrity. And with that, you have a sustainable workplace also for your company, not only for the individuals working there, feeling safe, but also seeing it from a business angle, that your human resources stay with you and what they learned and what they give in for the company will keep growing, and it also will reflect in all the revenues and all these key parameters that are so important for the high performance world. And the economy only looks at those factors. So I think friendliness is like the basis for sustainable work environment, to also encourage people to work harder in tough times. If you're not friendly, your coworkers won't do that for kind of you, because they know you are their leader. So they do it for you, kind of, instead of for the anonymous company being behind it.
Yeah, I think.
And the basis of loyalty, right?
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think, you know, just this point, I think all of us feel this particularly acutely this last year. And I mean, I don't know that it was ever different before this. It's just that we felt it more this last year. Things are uncertain and impermanent. And even like, for example, I think of my own business as a very much a startup, very risky on some level when you start something new, that even if something can't be super stable from an outer condition standpoint, to at least be transparent about that, you know, to have a transparent leadership style that says, here's where there's risk. And here's where we're doing well, and here's where we might not do as well if we don't hit these measures. And I think having, and you mentioned it before in terms of both vulnerability and authenticity, and it takes vulnerability to be able to be transparent. And transparency does equal, I think, authenticity, because you're not hiding anything. It's just as it is. And I love this, what you said about friendliness, because it's an attitude. It's a mindset that, like, whatever happens, this is how we're going to treat each other. And so, yeah, I think it's creating cultures that people want to be a part of.
I think also COVID showed that, right? Because when everyone moved into the home office, at least I saw some very interesting research and studies on that. Leaders were not just asking for the numbers anymore, but they bothered to ask how people were doing, and they started to care. And what happened was not that the numbers went down and south. The opposite was true. Numbers went high as hell, I think, at least it was the case in our law firm. And I think that's because when you see that your managers or your leaders are caring for you or your employees, that creates the loyalty and the drive for you to perform, because I think everyone has it in himself or herself to perform and to deliver. We always want that. But the question is, for whom or what do we want to do that? Not just for numbers or, don't know, the higher economics or whatever or what have you, but for the persons and values that are behind that, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think the more that your personal values align to the company values that are not just stated on paper, but actually lived, then there'll be a greater resonance between how you feel about what you do for that company. And I think it's sort of a nice segue to the idea that what motivated us in the past may not be what's motivating us today. And thankfully so, because I think being able to be agents of world benefit, helpful to ourselves and others, is sort of the highest level I can think of that we can operate that has everybody's well-being in mind. And I think it's something that everybody in some way can get on board with, hopefully, over time.
So would you say, is there anything we haven't asked you yet, but which you think is so important our listeners should have heard that in order to really understand emotional intelligence and the work you do, and especially to understand how important it is for business world and to thrive in your workplace and to have a community in which you as a leader and your colleagues do feel safe to thrive, also sometimes with their weaknesses?
Nice. So I don't think I've left out any sort of huge major points. I'll just sort of close with the idea in mind that we do each have agency. We do have influence in our own lives. And being able to locate those moments in which we do have influence starts with connecting with your own intrinsic awareness. And so when you are able to locate that in yourself and to gain familiarity and practice, then even in a very turbulent, uneasy, uncertain situation, you can connect with the stronghold of yourself and bringing yourself to a place where there's some internal stability in a situation that is otherwise impermanent and not particularly stable.
That's so nicely said.
Michelle, to round everything off, we've heard that something really interesting and exciting is going on. You're currently writing your own book. Do you want our listeners to know what you're writing about? And do you even know the title and when it will be released?
Yes, thank you for asking. Yes, it's true. I have been writing a book. And right now, and I don't think the title will change at this point, is called Emotionally Intelligent Habits, A Guide to Accessing Your Full Potential. And and the book is essentially about a lot of the things we've been talking about. And most specifically about how perception works and what are those habits that we're completely unaware of because we do them so automatically, and yet they determine every single result we're getting in our life today. And how do we unpack that for ourselves in real terms and start to understand where we have some influence in our own lives? And so I think I've touched on a lot of the main points in the book, but I'd say the last point is just that we each do have the wherewithal to make any change in our lives that we think is worth making. And so it starts from a desire, though, to want to do that. That has to come internally. That has to be intrinsic. And that's the starting place.
We will certainly get a copy of that book, I'm pretty sure. Do we already know when it will be released? Is there an ETA?
We were aiming for September, but due to me and being over the word count, I think we're looking more at October timeframe, and we'll be offering a masterclass at that time frame, and we'll have a book for everybody hopefully going through that course. So yeah, it's exciting. The cover's already been chosen, and I'm very thrilled about it. I'm over the moon, in fact. So it's a real honor.
One final question we would, and we do ask that to all of our guests. Is there any final advice you would like to give to our listeners regarding emotional intelligence and for their life journey going forward?
That's a great question. I'll refer to, it's a quote really from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which is what I practice on a personal level. And it's a saying that goes like this: keep your view higher than the sky and your actions finer than flour. And I'll leave it to you to figure out what that means.
Beautiful insights you shared with us and our listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. And I'm excited for us to connect in the future and see where your work goes. And thank you so much for doing this and for caring enough about the topic to find me and to take this time. Thank you.